And good evening, everyone. It's good to be back with you all this week on a beautiful spring day. Let's call it spring, shall we? It feels like spring. Last week, we spent our time in Revelation chapter 12. It's one of the more interesting chapters in the book of Revelation, insofar as it appears to be a dramatic portrayal of the manifestation of Christ on earth, of Satan's attempt to do away with him, but Christ's ultimate triumph. And we also have enacted for us by the angelic host a depiction of what was happening in parallel at the time of Christ's crucifixion, that while Jesus was facing death as he hung on the cross, that there was a war going on in heaven between Michael, the archangel, and the heavenly host, and Satan and his angels. Satan and his angels are cast to the earth, and Satan is intent upon opposing God's people. That's the narrative that we see in Revelation chapter 12. And just to kind of give us another way of thinking about this, looking at this, the woman who gives birth to the male child represents the remnant of God's people. She first represents the remnant of those faithful Israelites who preserve the lineage intact from Abraham to David down to Jesus so that Christ could come into the world. We see Satan opposing Jesus from his very birth. Herod intended on putting Jesus to death, but God provided a way for Jesus to be rescued from that. He sent him to Egypt. The male child Jesus is caught up into heaven. We talked about how that seems to symbolize the resurrection and glorification of Jesus, that he at that point can no longer be touched by Satan, that he is protected from him. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we have this heavenly battle that parallels the crucifixion. Satan lost that battle. He is cast to earth. And in conquering Satan, Jesus gives the faithful a strategy to overcome him. We talked about how they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. That's how the martyrs conquered Satan and his attempt to stamp out the church early on, and that's how we continue to overcome the prince of this world. But Satan being cast to the earth means trouble for those outside God's kingdom. It's going to mean trouble for us, but ultimately the ones who are going to pay the real price are those who are outside the kingdom of God. In fact, the angel laments the trouble that Satan is about to stir up on the earth. There's one piece of this imagery that I failed to talk about last week, and it happens early on in the 12th chapter of Revelation. And let me pull that up here real quick. I don't have my Bible open to it just yet. But you might notice in verse number 4, Satan's tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them down to the earth. Last week we talked about how stars can represent important people, but they also can represent angels. And there's a symbolic connection between angels and stars in Scripture. And if you think about what happened in the ministry of Jesus, one of the more remarkable aspects to that ministry is all of a sudden we have demon possession happening. That's something that has no precedent. We don't see that in the Old Testament. This was something new. And I wonder if those stars being cast to the earth right around the time that the woman was prepared to deliver the male child, that that might not represent Satan putting his minions to work in the possession of people and in other ways. So I just wanted to throw that possibility out there. I neglected to mention that last week, but I wanted to be sure to mention that to you this week. So that's one possible way of interpreting that particular part of the prophecy. All right, well, that takes us down through verse number 13. We're going to start some new material this evening, and the next couple of weeks, things are going to slow down significantly because we're heading back into one of those parts of Revelation that's very dense in its symbolism, and it's going to take us a little bit of time to unpack meaning and connect that together with the historical record. But let's pick up in chapter 12, verse number 13. Now, when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring to keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. As we talked about last week, the woman can mean a couple of different things in this 12th chapter. She starts out as representing the faithful of Israel, but once Jesus is caught up to heaven, she transitions to the faithful within the church. And really, we're talking about one and the same, aren't we? That even though we make this distinction between the descendants of Abraham and the church, really, we're just talking about the faithful people of God across all time. And what seems to be happening in these verses is Satan is assaulting the church. He can't touch Jesus, but he can touch Jesus' people. He can attack Jesus' people, so to speak. So the dragon had been cast to earth. He persecutes the woman. And as I mentioned a moment ago, he can't touch Jesus, but he can attack him indirectly. And that reminds me of what Jesus said to Saul on the road to Damascus. Saul is imprisoning the church. He intends to destroy the church. And Jesus asks him on the road, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" So even though Satan could not get to Jesus, he could get to Jesus indirectly by attacking the church. But God provides a way for the church to escape from him. And this doesn't mean necessarily that she is not going to be affected by what Satan is doing, but rather that God is going to protect her and preserve her through these trials. She is given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished. And that language is reminiscent of what God said to the children of Israel in Exodus chapter 19, verse number 4. He says to the children of Israel, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." So this is the language of deliverance, that God has taken his people away from their enemies. He has provided a place to shelter them, to nourish them, to protect them. And so the parallels between the children of Israel leaving Egypt and the church going into the wilderness are very, very deep and very clear. She's not only protected, but she's also nourished while she's in the wilderness for a time, times, and half a time. There's that familiar imagery coming back again, this 1,260 days, this 3.5 years, this time period of 42 months. The serpent spewed water out of his mouth in order to attack the woman. Now, this is kind of interesting because when you think of a dragon, you think of a dragon shooting out fire. But this is reminiscent of the Babylonian monster that doesn't spit out fire, but rather spits out water. It's that sort of imagery. And the waters are representative of peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues, according to Revelation chapter 17, verse 15. So what Satan is trying to do is he's trying to drown the church in the midst of the population of the world. He's trying to overwhelm the church by just sheer numbers. And as we're going to see in chapter 13, Satan is going to use one of his main tools. He's going to use the governments of this world in order to suppress, persecute, and in his estimation, to attempt to annihilate the true church. So the dragon has set its sights on the woman, but The earth is going to help the woman. The earth opens its mouth and swallows up the flood. Moses, in Exodus chapter 15, verse number 12, speaking about Pharaoh and his army, says, "You stretched out your right hand and the earth swallowed them." Now, of course, Pharaoh and his armies were swallowed up by the waters of the Red Sea, but it's the same sort of idea that God provided protection by swallowing up the threat to his people. Numbers chapter 16, verses 31 and 32, about the concerns of the rebellion of Korah. And you might remember that the rebels were swallowed up by the earth. Once again, that's God protecting his people from the threat. In this case, the threat is false teaching or rebellion, if you will. So God saved his people from the threat of the Egyptians, and he saved his people from the threat of Korah and the rebellion that he was leading. This is almost also reminiscent of 2 Samuel chapter 22, verses 7 and 17 and 18. This is David. "In my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried out to my God. He heard my voice from his temple, and my cry entered his ears. He sent from above. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too strong for me." So here's God providing deliverance, God providing sanctuary, God protecting his faithful, depicted once again as protecting them from a great flood. So I just see this as God's way of being at work. He's aware of what's going on. He knows what Satan's intentions are, and he's going to provide ways for the church to survive in the midst of all this. But the dragon sees what God is doing, and that just makes him angrier. He becomes more enraged with the woman. She has escaped to the wilderness. God is protecting her, he is nourishing her, he is providing for her, and that just makes Satan that much angrier with God's people. So he decides to make war with her offspring. And the offspring, of course, represents the church. Remember what Paul says in the fourth chapter of the book of Galatians, "The Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all." So we are the offspring of this woman, of the faithful people of God. We also could link this up with what's said earlier in the 12th chapter, verse number 11. "The offspring are those who overcome Satan by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they do not love their lives to the death." And just as we have two women in two cities, we also have two different types of people in the book of Revelation. So the offspring of the woman are contrasted with the rest of mankind back in chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. We emphasized this when we were talking about the sixth trumpet, that the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of their works, of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts. So the offspring of the woman are contrasted with those who cling to their idols, who cling to their sin, who cling to their immorality. They do not abandon all of these things. The offspring are contrasted with those who dwell on the earth. And those who dwell on the earth worship the beast and the dragon who gives the beast his authority. And these are those whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So we have the faithful, the offspring of the woman, contrasted with the people of the earth. The people of the earth who worship idols, who are into sorcery, sexual immorality, so on and so forth. So now it's time to get into chapter 13. And as I mentioned a moment ago, chapter 13 is a very dense part of the book of Revelation. And thankfully, we have a couple of other chapters in the Bible that we can turn to help us unlock what exactly Revelation 13 means. We have a couple of chapters from the book of Daniel that we can look to. And we're also going to look extensively at chapter 17, because in chapter 17, an angel interprets the beast for John. So it's very helpful to look at chapter 17 and chapter 13 together. Let's go back to the Old Testament. Let's talk about Daniel for a moment. There's a couple of visions in the book of Daniel that are pertinent to our discussion this evening. And the first is found in Daniel chapter 2. It has to do with Nebuchadnezzar and his dream. You might remember that Nebuchadnezzar saw a great image that was made of four types of metals as well as clay: gold, silver, bronze, iron, and iron mixed with clay. Each one of these represents a kingdom. The gold represents Babylon. Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, "You are this head of gold." So Babylon is certainly the head of gold. The Medes and the Persians are represented by the chest and the arms of silver. The bronze represents Greece, the bronze belly and thighs, and the iron legs and the iron mixed with clay represents Rome. And it's during the time of this fourth kingdom, we're told in verse 44, that God is going to establish a fifth kingdom, a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And this kingdom is, of course, the kingdom of heaven. This is the church. And what we're told in the second chapter of Daniel is that the church would emerge in the days of this fourth empire, in the days of Rome. And ultimately, the church would vanquish the Roman Empire. Now, this is continued on five chapters later in the seventh chapter of Daniel, where Daniel sees four beasts in a dream. The first three beasts he sees are like animals. They look like a lion. It looks like the second one looks like a bear, and the third looks like a leopard. But the fourth beast that Daniel sees, he doesn't compare that beast to any other animal. It's different than the first three. And we learn in verse number 17 that those four beasts are four kingdoms. And these link up very well with those four kingdoms we're introduced to back in Daniel chapter 2, that the lion represents Babylon, the bear represents the Medes and the Persians, the leopard represents Greece, and then this fourth beast that cannot be described except in some very vague details is the kingdom of Rome. And this links us up with the beast in Revelation chapter 13, the fifth beast, or the first beast in Revelation 13. But still back in Daniel 7, the fourth beast, we're told, has teeth of iron and nails of bronze. So basically what we have is a bit of a composite. Bronze represents Greece. Iron represents Rome. You have a kingdom that is a blend of both Rome and Greece. And on this fourth beast are 10 horns. And that's an important detail because later on in Revelation 13, the beast, the first beast that John sees, has 10 horns on its body. And that mirrors also the 10 horns of Satan in Revelation chapter 12. And then there's another horn that rises up in the midst of these 10 horns. It's a little horn that speaks pompous words. It persecutes and makes war with the saints. It attempts to change times and law. It prevails for a time, times, and half a time. And that little horn seems to be the papacy, which I believe is represented by the second beast in Revelation chapter 13. We'll talk more about that connection probably in a couple of weeks. The last thing we learn about this beast in Daniel chapter 7 is that beast exists. That fourth beast exists in some form until the day of judgment. We can see that in Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 through 11. That's going to be continued on. That same idea is going to be continued in the book of Revelation. So let's talk about this beast, the fourth beast in Daniel 7 and the first beast in Revelation 13. I believe these beasts are one and the same. We're just getting two different views of the same creature. In Revelation chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, John stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. So this beast rises from the sea, and that should take us back. If you're familiar with Daniel chapter 7, that should take you back to the vision of Daniel, because Daniel sees each of these four beasts rise up out of the great sea, the Mediterranean, if you will. Now, a beast in apocalyptic literature represents a kingdom that is antagonistic to God and his people. And that's something we can link up with Daniel chapter 7, verse 17, and verse 23. So this is a kingdom that opposes God and opposes his people. And the sea out of which the beast rises represents a vast multitude of peoples. In Revelation 17 and 15, as I told you, Revelation 17 is an angel's interpretation of Revelation 13. The angel says, "The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues." So you have a kingdom that's rising up out of the midst of peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the beast is something else. He has seven heads, and we're told later on in chapter 17 that those seven heads represent seven hills or seven kings. If you're familiar with Rome, Rome was known as the city of seven hills. So the fact that the seven heads are described as seven hills is significant. The word king can be used interchangeably with kingdom. So kings and kingdoms basically are synonymous with one another in prophecy. So he has seven heads, which are seven hills or seven kings. And this beast also has ten horns. And we're told that those ten horns represent ten kings or ten kingdoms. We can link that up with Daniel chapter 7, verse 24. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kingdoms. These ten horns are given ten crowns. So these kingdoms are established and they're granted authority by the beast. As the angel says later on in chapter 17, verse 12, "The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast." And then on the head of this beast, or on the heads of this beast, is a blasphemous name. And of course, by blasphemy, we mean language that speaks evil of that which is high and holy. The blaspheme means to speak with intent to harm or intent to injure, intent to insult. And blasphemy is always used in connection with God and the people who are associated with it and objects that are associated with him. So this is a beast that is speaking evil of that which is high and holy. But what makes this beast different, and if you recall, back in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel does not compare that fourth beast to anything. Well, the reason why is because the beast we see in Revelation 13 is a composite. It's a combination of a leopard, it's got the feet of a bear, and it's got the mouth of a lion. Now, that should take us back to Daniel chapter 7. The leopard represents Greece, the bear represents Persia, and the lion represents Babylon. But remember in Daniel 7:19, this beast has teeth of iron, which reminds us of Rome, and it also has nails of bronze, which represents Greece. So what we have in this beast is basically a composite, a combination of all of these kingdoms, a summation of all of these kingdoms. And I'll tell you what I think that means a little bit later on toward the end of my slides this evening.
All right.
We're going to skip down to verse number 18 because I think it's just easier to cover verse 18. I'm still in Revelation 13. It's easier to cover verse 18 now rather than wait till later on because it just seems like it fits with what we're talking about in these early verses. The beast is given a number, the number 666. And of course, the number 6 represents mankind. Adam and Eve were created on the sixth day. It's important to bear in mind as we talk about what this number 666 means, it's important to remember that the book of Revelation was written in Greek. And in the Greek language, like the Latin language, they used letters to represent numbers. And it was Irenaeus back in the late second century who proposed what I think is the best solution to this. The number of the beast is its name. And Irenaeus proposed in the late second century, it seems to me very probable, for this is a name of the last of Daniel's four kingdoms, they being Latins that now reign. Here's how Irenaeus arrived at that conclusion. If you spell out Latins in Greek, this is how it is spelled. Lambda, which represents the number 30. Alpha, which represents the number 1. Tau, which represents the number 300. Epsilon, which represents the number 5. Iota, 10. Nu, 50. Omicron, 70. Sigma, 200. Add all of those together, and what number do you get? 666. Latinos, the Latin race. And I think that this solution makes a great deal of sense. And this doesn't prove anything. I just think it's kind of an interesting little sidebar to mention. Irenaeus was the student of Polycarp, who in turn was a student of John, who was the one who saw this series of visions in the book of Revelation. I don't know that Irenaeus had any sort of inside information on this. I'm not suggesting that at all. I just think that that connection is interesting, that you have a bit of a chain between John and the person who first proposed this solution. And I'll just mention this, and again, this doesn't prove anything. This is an appeal to an appeal to authority, so I just think it's interesting that those who are writing in the 100s, 200s AD did interpret the beast in Revelation the same way that Irenaeus did. They interpreted it as Rome, and that interpretation held for quite some time. It's only been in recent centuries that people have tried to shift that around. But that's a whole other matter. I'm just going to tell you why I think this solution makes sense. And it just begins with what Irenaeus observes in his quotation. Rome is the last kingdom in Daniel and in Nebuchadnezzar's visions. It's the kingdom that existed at the time of John, which I think is significant. When you compare the fourth beast in Daniel 7 and the first beast in Revelation 13, we see a tremendous amount of correspondence. These two beasts seem to be one in the same. They're both composites. They both are incomparable. There's not really anything one can compare them with. John does give us more of a description than Daniel, but even his description leaves us scratching our heads because we've never seen anything quite like it. They both have 10 horns. And in Revelation chapter 17, verse 10, again, this is the angel interpreting the beast for John. This is what he says about the 7 heads. There are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. This to me just seems to favor the interpretation of the beast representing Rome. The angel is telling John that one of these heads exists right now. So that just naturally lends itself to this particular interpretation. Now, you may hear interpreted in other ways by other teachers, but this is the way that I favor for these reasons. Let's talk about these 7 heads. And these 7 heads, as I mentioned a moment ago, 5 have fallen. 7 heads on a single body, In Daniel chapter 7, verse 6, we're told that the leopard-like animal that represents Greece has four heads on a single body. When you look at Greek history, we see Alexander the Great conquered this wide swath of territory from Macedonia and Greece all the way east to the very edge of modern-day India. But Alexander died, and his kingdom was divided up by the four strongest generals. So that single kingdom was divided up into four powers. A single body, but four heads in the case of Greece. And in this particular beast, we have seven heads and a single body. As the angel says to John, five have fallen. And what I think that represents is there have been five phases of Roman power that have passed prior to the time of this vision. So there's been different manifestations of Roman power in the past. And it just so happens that the greatest of Roman historians, who was alive at the time that Revelation was revealed to John, talks about the types of government that preceded the Roman emperors. And he just so happens to list five different types of Roman government. They were first ruled by kings, then later councils, dictators, decemvirs, a council of ten, and military tribunes. Now, those last few were all during the time of the Republic. There were times where the Republic would set aside, the Senate would set aside its power and invite a single man to lead the nation in a time of war. That's that whole idea of councils or dictators. But Tacitus in his day identified five different types of governing power that had preceded the Roman emperors. In chapter 17, verse 10, one of these heads, the angel says, one of those heads is, one is. What he's saying is one of these heads is alive at this time. It's contemporaneous with John. And I think that that represents the pagan emperors who began with Caesar Augustus back in 36 BC and stretched all the way to Aurelian in 282 AD. So a period of a little over 300 years. So there is a type of government that is in power right now in Rome. And there is one that is to come. And as we talked about several weeks ago when we were looking at the sixth seal and Constantine, Diocletian and then the man who followed him, Constantine, basically formed an entirely new government. It was a complete transformation. And of course, Constantine continued that transformation by converting to Christianity and moving the Roman Empire in the direction of embracing Christianity. So that was a whole new phase, if you will. So you have these five that have passed away, this one that exists right now, the pagan emperors from Augustus to Aurelian, and one who has yet to come. And that one that is yet to come will only continue for a short time. The reforms of Diocletian and Constantine were short-lived because they only lasted about 150 years. The Western Roman Empire fell in 476, and it seemed at that point that Rome was on the ropes. But as we're going to learn later on, the beast, even though it appears to be dead, is not in fact dead. It is revived later on. All right. On the heads of this beast is a blasphemous name. And this is where I think it might be good just to remind ourselves that in the ancient world, there was a strong unity between religion and state. It was not unusual for kings to also be the heads of their religion. And that was certainly the case in Rome. Roman emperors were often deified by the public. As early as 36 BC, some Italian cities had given Octavian, who is Caesar Augustus, a place in their pantheon. By 27 BC, his name was added to those of the gods in official hymns at Rome. His birthday became a holy day as well as a holiday. And after his death, the Senate decreed that his genius, or his soul, was thereafter to be worshipped as one of the official divinities. And this was pretty common in Rome. They deified their emperors. And Roman religion was deeply enmeshed with the Roman government that stretches back centuries. In fact, when Augustus came to the throne, one of his objectives was to revive the Roman religion. It had sort of fallen out of practice among the multitudes, and he wanted to infuse it with new life because he saw this as the way to revive Rome, to bring it into a new phase of glory. So religion and state were joined at the hip. They are one in the same. This whole idea of separation between church and state, this is a very new development in human history. Later on, Diocletian, who preceded Constantine, developed the cult of the emperor's genius into a personal worship of himself as the earthly embodiment of Jupiter. Boy, talk about shooting for the moon, so to speak. Wisdom and force had come down from heaven to restore order and peace on earth. That was Durant's commentary about that. So Diocletian wanted to be worshipped as the manifestation, as the human embodiment of the god Jupiter. So I think this is probably what this whole idea of a blasphemous name means. We've got this pagan religion that's married with the state, and that, of course, is an affront to God. The creature, rather than the creator, is being glorified in this. So let's talk about these seven heads. Let's look back for just a moment and see if we can kind of put all this back together here in a way that might be at least somewhat understandable. So five of these heads have fallen, and those, I believe, are the phases of Roman power described by Tacitus. One is, these are the Roman emperors from Augustus to Aurelian, and one is yet to come. And I believe that that one yet to come is the reorganized empire started by Diocletian and completed by Constantine. It was a completely new order. And the blasphemous names on the head, I see this as the integration of religion and state. First, under the pagan religion of Rome, but we're also going to see church and state joined at the hip later on, because there's another phase of Roman power yet to come. As we learn in chapter 17, the beast itself is an eighth. And we'll talk about what that means next week, Lord willing. At least I don't think it's in my notes tonight. Let's talk about these 10 horns. These 10 horns, as I mentioned a moment ago, are 10 kingdoms. We're told that in Daniel chapter 7, verse 24. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom. And the angel over in chapter 17, verse 12, tells John, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. All right. So these 10 horns are going to arise out of the Roman Empire. They were not in power in John's day. They have not received a kingdom yet, says the angel. And they'll rule separately from the beast for a time, for a short while. But eventually they're going to surrender their authority to the beast. Notice how the angel explains this. But they receive authority for 1 hour with the beast. And they will give their power and authority to the beast. And they will participate in making war with Jesus and persecuting his saints. We'll talk more about that when we get down into chapter 13, verse number 7, probably in a couple of weeks. So these 10 horns, what are they? I believe these 10 horns represent the rise of the European powers. Beginning a few centuries before Christ, Teutonic or Germanic tribes, you'll see them called both in the literature, begin migrating west out of Asia, and they settle in north central Europe. And when the Roman Empire started pushing its borders to the north into Europe, they found numerous hosts of Germanic tribes. And what had pushed these Germanic tribes west was the Huns coming out of China. There was a global warming period that was happening, and there was famine and drought in China, so the Huns began pushing west. And as they pushed west, those Germanic tribes were pushed further west into Europe. And as Rome began to move north into Europe, they began encountering these Germanic powers. And the rise of these Germanic powers correspond with Daniel chapter 7, verse 24's description. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom. I've got a quotation here from the Oxford Illustrated History of Christianity. I think I've used this before. I think I may have quoted this back in chapter 11. If one were writing the history of Western Europe in the period from about 330 to 700 AD, there would inevitably be two major themes. The first would tell of the late Roman Empire and its fate after the reorganization by emperors Diocletian and Constantine until most of its western provinces were superseded by barbarian kingdoms. The second theme would be the story of these new nations, the Germanic kingdoms, whose foundations were laid during the years from about 400 to 600 AD. Durant, in his book, The Age of Faith, writes this: historically, the conquest destroyed the outward form of what was already inwardly decayed. He's talking about the conquering of the Western Roman Empire. So Rome was decaying from within. It was conquered from without by these Germanic tribes. This conquering cleared away, with regrettable brutality and thoroughness, a system of life which, with all its gifts of order, culture, and law, had worn itself into senile debility and had lost the powers of regeneration and growth. A new beginning was now possible. The empire of the West faded, but the states of modern Europe were born. So these 10 horns, I believe, represent the rise of these European powers, rising out of the ashes of the Western Roman Empire, replacing what had grown old and decayed from within. Now, I want to get back to this idea of the beast being a composite of a leopard, a bear, and a lion. And let's just go back and do a quick review, just kind of get all this in our head for a moment. What you basically have happening over a period of about, 600 years, is a succession of kingdoms that are essentially ruling some of the same territory. It begins, of course, with Babylon, who back in Daniel chapter 2 is the head of gold, and in Daniel chapter 7 is represented by a creature that looks something like a lion. Babylon is succeeded by Persia. Persia represents, or is represented by, the arms and chests of silver in Daniel chapter 2. It's represented by the bear in Daniel chapter 7, and it's represented by a ram in Daniel chapter 8. Greece is represented by the belly and thighs of bronze in Daniel 7, by the leopard in Daniel, the belly and thighs of bronze in Daniel chapter 2, the leopard in Daniel chapter 7, and a male goat in Daniel chapter 8. And Rome is represented by legs and feet mixed of iron and clay and the fourth indescribable beast. Each one of these kingdoms succeed one another. Babylon begins it. Persia conquers Babylon. Greece conquers Persia. Rome conquers Greece. As Zechariah chapter 2, verse number 9 says, each nation became spoil for their servants. Each empire fell victim to the power that followed them. And thinking about this imagery, this combination of the leopard and the lion and the bear in that beast in Revelation 13, see if you can visualize it this way. This was the territory that was controlled by the Neo-Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar, Nabopolassar, Nabonidus, and Belshazzar. It was a short-lived empire. It basically controlled what we call the Fertile Crescent, right? Nice crescent moon shape there. Babylon was conquered by Persia. This is the Achaemenid Persian Empire around 500 BC. And you'll notice that it basically controls all the territory that Babylon controlled. The Fertile Crescent is under its control at this point, but they extend it further outward. Here's the empire of Alexander the Great. Once again, you can see that Fertile Crescent that was originally conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, it's been absorbed into the empire of Alexander the Great. And of course, continue on, the Roman Empire, once again, it controls that same territory. Of course, it's far more extensive than those others. The reason I bring this up is these empires were basically building on top of one another. There's a tremendous amount of intermingling happening here. When Alexander the Great pushed east, he was getting information and ideas from places as far away from China, traveling down the routes that would later become known as the Silk Road. So Greece was influenced by the Oriental influence of the Far East and was beginning to mix all these things together. Greece was influenced by Persia. And all of this influence fell to Rome as well. All of these things are just sort of mixed up together. And that's why I think this beast in Revelation 13 is a composite. As Durant observed in his book, The Life of Greece, civilization does not die, it migrates. It changes its habitat and its dress, but it lives on. The decay of one civilization as of one individual makes room for the growth of another. Life sheds the old skin and surprises death with fresh youth. If you want something to latch on to that might make a little bit more sense to you, think about America. We talk about the Judeo-Christian influence on America, but that's not the only influence that we see in the formation of our country. Our founding fathers were reading Aristotle. They were reading the Greek philosophers. They were modeling our form of government after things that they read about Greece and about Rome. You also see the Scottish Enlightenment contributing a great deal to our founding documents, the writings of men like Locke, the capitalist system that was developed by Adam Smith. These were all major influences that, when you kind of bring them all together, created this wonderful place that we call America. We are, in many ways, a composite. And that's what I think is happening with this beast in Revelation 13. Babylon influenced Persia, who influenced Greece, who influenced Rome. Rome was just the next layer on top of these predecessors. The beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. All right, so let's talk about what we talked about tonight. Let's sum this up. I just threw a whole lot of information at you, and thankfully we're recording this so you can go back and listen to it again if you need to. So what do we see happening in chapter 12, verse 13 through chapter 13, verse 2? Well, we have Satan the dragon who makes war against the church using all means at his disposal. I think we can say that Rome, this first beast in Revelation 13, was a manifestation of Satan's power. The beast in Revelation 13 has seven heads and ten horns. That corresponds with the seven heads and ten horns of the dragon in chapter 12. So Rome is a manifestation of Satan's power, and Rome was Satan's tool to use in persecution of the church. Rome itself was a composite of earlier kingdoms. It conquered and assimilated the nations and cultures of those more ancient empires. And finally, out of the fall of the Western Roman Empire would emerge the kingdoms of Europe, those ten horns. They emerge out of the ashes of the Western Roman Empire. That's basically what we talked about tonight, just in a brief slide. I'll ring the bell here and ask if there's any questions or comments. Oh. Do you want to wait for the microphone? Okay. All right, Allison, go ahead. Yes.
So I was like, I wonder if that's the origin of like where Dalmatian dogs came from. Yeah. And it is.
It is, isn't it?
I had to Google it.
Yeah. There you go. Google wins again. Yeah.
What that has to do with anything else we're talking about.
Nothing, but it is an interesting factoid, so if you're ever on Final Jeopardy, you know where Dalmatians came from. Thank you, Allison. Any other questions or comments? Anybody else got one? Miles has got something back there. The bell did ring, right? I thought I heard it. Did anybody else hear it? Okay. I'll do it one more time. I heard it that time. Go ahead, Miles.
So you may have commented on this, and I could have very well missed it, but you covered the seven heads, ten horns and the blasphemous name above the heads, but what were the ten crowns?
Yeah, so the crowns represent the kingdoms that these horns eventually, so these all start out as these sort of loose coalitions of Germanic tribes, but eventually they develop into the kingdoms of Europe. Okay. So the Franks and the Visigoths and the Angles and Saxons and the Utes, you know, these kingdoms later become France and Germany and England. And so the crowns are those kingdoms that emerge from those tribes that are migrating west out of Asia.
Were the origination of the Western of Europe.
Yeah.
And then the crowns were
the kingdoms that arose out of there. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And we could even take that a step further because each of those kingdoms in time acquiesced to the power of the Roman Church. And eventually a king could not be crowned in Europe unless they were crowned by the Church of Rome, which there you go. There's your little hint. The eighth manifestation of Roman power, I believe, is the ecclesiastical hierarchy of the Roman Church, the priests, the bishops, the cardinals, all those people. So yeah. Yeah. March has got something here. Yeah. The little horn we're going to get into, when we talk about the second beast in Revelation 13, the little horn, I believe, is the papacy. That's the best. The papacy. Yeah. The office of the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. Yeah. Good question. All right. Any other questions or comments? Anybody else want to venture in here? Okay. Well, we're all just about upstairs. Let's see. Ginger has printed session 12. Is it in the back? It's in the back. So make sure you grab it on your way out. Next week we're going to cover about 6 verses. So it's going to be pretty dense and it's going to be that way, unfortunately, for a couple of weeks, but I don't know what else to do. We've got to work our way through this and make some sense of it as I'll try to make as much sense of it as I possibly can. So make sure you grab session 12 so you're all ready for next week's class. Let's go ahead and turn this off. There we go. We were talking about Daniel chapter 2 and about the fifth kingdom that would arise in the time of Rome. And in that dream, Nebuchadnezzar sees a stone cut out of a mountain without hands. And that stone, of course, represents Jesus. And he sees the stone grow into a great mountain. And of course, mountains and prophecies represent kingdoms. So Nebuchadnezzar sees this stone cut out of a mountain, a nation, that in turn becomes a mountain, a nation itself. And I think that that prophecy is beautiful because Jesus came out of the nation of Israel. He's a descendant of Abraham. And out of the nation of Israel came the stone which the builders rejected. And he's become the chief cornerstone of the church. He's the one upon which the foundation, upon which we build our lives. And that is the kingdom. The kingdom is the church. That's the mountain that grew out of the great stone. And if you're not a part of the kingdom tonight, we offer you an opportunity to become a citizen, so to speak. If you're ready to be born again and become a part of the kingdom of God, please come forward as we stand and sing the number that Brian has selected.